see you all. Okay, thank you. It's going to warm up a little bit, so I'm just, you know, if it's too warm in here, everyone falls asleep, so I just want to make sure. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Exactly. It's already at 62, so.
No.
I'm just kidding. But I apologize. Hopefully by next week we'll have the schedule up and running. Okay, good to see you. So we have been going through this wonderful sefer called Be'er HaGola. And the goal of this book, written by the Maharal, is to address different questions and concerns that people have about the rabbis, okay? So the past class is a little more systematic in terms of addressing particular concerns and trying to frame a little bit better for us to understand the role of the rabbis and the dynamic between the written law and the oral law, and explaining the relationship between them. You know, one of the examples that he gave was almost, without reviewing it right now, it's going to take us a little bit too long, but today, I just want to frame what we're doing today. Today's a little bit almost like, we're just going to be wrapping up some of the previous ideas that we touched upon. Even if you haven't been in the last classes, it's okay. But we're not going to be covering as much novel ground in and of itself in terms of the big ideas. But I think we'll have new understandings of a couple of different laws and different statements. So I think today's class is going to be in some ways almost a review, but in some ways, connected to earlier ideas. And then next week, we're going to start a new topic within this category. Yes.
So I listen to Meir Soloveitchik, mm-hmm. And he has a series on Avot. Mm-hmm. If people listen to the first one, mm-hmm. it's all about the rabbis.
Interesting.
And
interesting.
Who they are, and then it isn't just saying that right. Each one of them reflects a particular perspective of a particular rabbi. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So people are interested.
Interesting.
Is, because it's the same.
Yeah.
It's all about who really were each of these
beautiful.
Guys.
Beautiful. Okay. Anything Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik says is usually brilliant, so it's worth listening to. Okay. So today we're going to have three mini topics. The first is, just give a little quick introduction. There's something called a punishment called Malkus, which means lashes. Okay. Let's remind ourselves that in the Torah, from the Torah's perspective, when the Beis HaMikdash stood and when the courts were up and running, they administered capital punishments. So people were, it depends on the crime, they could actually get capital punishments. As we spoke about, we'll talk about again today, extremely rare. We'll speak a little bit about why and how. But there are a number of punishments that the Beis Din would do. One of the, if it wasn't capital punishment, the most typical punishment was lashes, okay? People would get lashes if they would violate certain crimes. And again, they'd have to be warned before. We're not going to unpack right now, the validity and why. You know, it's a little bit off-putting, I think, to the modern ear. The notion of a court going ahead and giving someone lashes doesn't sit well, I think, with many of us. Maybe it does. I don't know. But we're not going to get into that too much. What I want to focus on is one particular detail about the lashes. Anyone know how many lashes were given to the individual?
39.
39 lashes were given. What's interesting, though, is what does the Torah say?
40.
The Torah says, Arba'im Yakenu. The Torah says, give 40 lashes. And then there is an entire tractate in the Talmud, Mishnah and Talmud, called Makos, which literally means lashes. And there, one of the first laws we learn is not 40, 39. And of course, you read this, right? Usually the rabbis get in trouble for adding, right? For making things more stringent. Over here, they're taking away. And the question is, where does this come from? It seems so bizarre. The Torah says explicitly 40. And they go ahead and they give 39 lashes. So again, this is just one of many examples where people are like, hey, what are these rabbis doing? You know, here's the written law. And they're doing something else, right? Again, one of the biggest complaints dating all the way back, even before Christianity, is that the rabbis are corrupting the Torah. Right? That is the big complaint. The rabbis are corrupting that. The Torah on its own would be a very different religion, and the rabbis are corrupting it. So where are they? You know, that's the main overarching complaint. So this is just one of many examples. Again, over here, it's not a stringency. It's a leniency. They are giving less punishment. Where does it come from? And that's really the first thing he's going to address today. Okay? So let's, yeah.
Other countries still do that.
They do. Most of the Western country, right, in the Western world, I don't think we have it. But yeah, certainly in the Middle East, in certain places, or Africa, you have some places which still administer lashes. Yeah. Yeah, they also had capital punishments. Again, now we'll talk a little bit about capital punishment today. As we'll see, extremely rare, and we'll talk a little bit about why that is the case. So let's jump in now. First, we'll focus on the lash itself. So on the first page, Amna, Masha Amru Ki Garu Batorah. That they said, who's they? They are the critics of what we'll call rabbinic Judaism, that they said, ki garu batorah, that the rabbis removed, they lessened from what the Torah said. Sha Torah amra, the Torah says, arba'im yakenu, that the individual will get 40 lashes. Veheim amru, and they, the rabbis said, misbar hamakos lamites. They said, 39 lashes. What's going on over here? That's the question we just asked. So now he goes into an explanation in terms of where the rabbis were coming from. So he says like this. First, ki amekubal etzlam, there was a tradition that the rabbis had. You know, use the word by tradition. When we say tradition, we mean, and that goes to the first mission Avos, of Pirkei Avos, where it talks about this chain that goes from God to Moshe, from Moshe to Yeshua, and Yeshua to the different elders, and ultimately to the rabbis who authored the Mishnah. There's a very clear delineated chain. You can know this person and this person as his teacher, this person and this person as his teacher, and there's this chain. So we say there is a Kabbalah we oftentimes use for the esoteric things, but the more basic understanding of the word Kabbalah means is tradition. That there was some knowledge that was passed on. What was the knowledge? Ki mispar hamakos arba'im, the number 40 of the lashes, kineged yitzira sa'adam, shenotzar barba'im yom, corresponds to the individual, or the fetus, which develops within 40 days. Okay? So even modern science will tell you, again, there's, you know, the exact number, but even modern people tell you that within the 40 days is really when the fetus starts to develop into something. We'll talk about heartbeats, etc. We're not going to get into the abortion discussion right now, but that's, you know, you'll hear the number 40 will come up, or around 40 will come up a lot, because that's when the development really begins, okay, into something which we'll call more lifelike than what preceded it. There's a very qualitative difference. And so there is this notion that 40 days is the amount of time it takes for the fetus to really start to develop. Okay? Kemoshi Yadua Davarzei says this matter is known. Vigemar Yitzi Raso, Hu Biyom Arbaim. And the 40th day is when that development ends. Okay? Fine. That's point number one. Veachet, so first of all, you have to know that the lashes correspond to the 40 days that the development of an individual. So what that means conceptually is that where did the Torah, why does God choose to give us 40 lashes? You said 10. 10's a more Jewish number, 10 commandments, or maybe 13 lashes. Who knows? 3 lashes, 1 lash for God. I don't know. Where does 7, right? Where does number 40 come from? Right? So it's not just a magical, mystical number. The idea is that 40 days is seen as the time of development of what it really means. That means that, you know, the human being has been developed, you know, there's a qualitative development at that point, and therefore the lashes in some way are coming to negate, as we'll see, some flaw in an individual. 40 days represents the development of who we are coming into ourselves, and therefore the lashes in some ways are meant to, you know, almost remove. If you recall from our last course, we spoke about the punishments of Gehenim, of the purgatory. And the idea was that, you know, whatever that suffering is, which we spoke about, it removes, you know, some of the blemishes, some of the impediments that we have. So similarly, if it takes 40 days to develop, that means there's something wrong within that development, and the 40 lashes in some ways cleanses that development. Okay? It gives us like almost like a fresh start. Okay? That's point number one. We'll come back to this. Ve'achit she'adam chote, and the sin that a man sins, or a person sins, hubala adam mitzad hachomer bilvad. It comes about through chomer, through their material essence. Ki mitzad hatsura ein chet klal. When it comes to their form, there is no sin. Okay, so before your eyes gloss over, let me explain for a second what this means. Anyone here take philosophy 101 in college? I shouldn't raise my hand because I didn't. Okay, yeah. But so there's two terms that comes up a lot. Comes up in Aristotelian thought, and that is chomer and tzura, which in English, material and form. Okay, material and form. These terms sound all familiar. They will not help you in your regular day life, so if it makes sense, you forgot about it. But material and form are terms that, you know, one of the things Aristotle did when he was very instrumental was helping us, like, conceptualize the world around us. He was the great categorizer. He took, you know, he understood there's flowers and there's types of plants, etc. And so his job was, he tried to break things down. He tried to help us understand things, you know, for what they are, and gave terms to help us conceptualize each thing and break it down into components. So one of the terms that he uses, I don't think he was the one who came up with it, but one of the terms that he uses is that there is the material element of an item, and then there is the form of an item. So what does that mean? Let's. I guess we'll use this table in front of me as an example. So this table in front of me, you could say the material elements. We'll say what's in front of me. So if I'm looking at it from a material perspective, I would say, well, there's pieces of metal, That's metal, yeah. There's a piece of metal. There's probably some plastic stuff over there. And then there's some screws. There's some wood. There's some plastic over here. And a little bit of metal over here. That's the material, right? But that's chomer, material. The tzura is, there's a table, right? It's all those pieces, the spirit of it, meaning the what it really is, all those things coming together, what it is, and on a much deeper level, it's not just it's larger than the sum total, right? Well, I wouldn't say it that way. The point is that the material elements, we can list all the material elements, but the form is literally its form. It's what it is. It's bigger than, and again, the sum is greater than the total, what's the phrase? The sum of its parts. Thank you, right? It's greater than the different elements. The form is something else, right? So that's one way of looking at it. And so always, material is always going to be seen as like the material things, which are more, less spiritual. And form is always seen in a much more, is seen as things which are much more spiritual. Like our soul is what animates us. Can I touch and feel my soul? No. But, you know, what are you looking at over here? You're looking at a lump of flesh and sinews and bones and teeth and I don't know whatever it is that I'm made up of. I don't know biology that well, but whatever. Sorry.
A lot of water.
Thank you, doctor. Mostly water, right? That's what we're looking at. But that's the material, right? The tzura, the soul, the form is what it actually is and what animates it, and therefore the soul is oftentimes associated with tzura because the fact that it's really what distinguishes between just being a clump over here of stuff and something which is very different. Sort of with me? Right? Okay. So he says like this. He says, sin is always going to be associated with chomer, the material that makes up the thing. Mitzad hatzura, but from the perspective of form, ein chet klal, there is no sin. Vilmalei lo haya chomer, if there's no material things in the world, haya adam kadosh v'torah min achet, a person would be completely pure and holy, free from sin. In other words, it's only because we are material, because we're made up of, let's think about it in terms of our own practical life. What lends us to sin, right? Anyone here perfect? Great, okay, good. So we all make mistakes, right? Where, if I had to point to something, where that comes from, right? My soul is pure, it's elevated, it's drawn after only spiritual things. The point is that I'm more than just a soul, right? I'm a soul and other things. I'm my physicality, right? Again, just to be clear, as Jews, we don't see physicality as intrinsically evil. This is not a Christian view where that we're eternally damned or anything of that nature. But the point is that it's because of my physical existence, my chomer, my material, that I am connected to sin. So meaning, I'm lazy, let's just say, right? So where does that come from? It doesn't come from my soul. It comes from my physical constitution, my brain. Not to exclude my brain and whatever, but it's more associated with the material parts of my life. Are we with me a little bit? Yeah, a little complicated. Okay.
Can I ask you to extend a little bit on that analogy with, mm-hmm. say, the screws and things, right?
Yeah.
Because there's... If you talk about the material, right, the screws, there's the table. But let's say the tabletop, right, it's composed of things, which mm-hmm. is composed of things. And eventually you get down to molecules, then you get down to atoms, and then they think they found stuff smaller than that. Eventually you get down to something that probably just Hashem knows about, right, not us.
Okay.
Okay. So at what point do we determine something is a material versus the form of the material?
So even in using that analogy, you know, using what you're describing, like even the nano atoms or whatever they are, right? Those are still going to be material because they are the things that just are making up something else. So even though, yes, there might be a spiritual, from a different angle, you might say, hey, there's some spiritual something guiding them, but they're still the material that are not an entity. The tzura literally means form. It's what forms all these things together. It's what brings it all together. So breaking things down is always going to be more Homer-like. Tzura is always going to be when you're bringing things together.
But a molecule itself is Homer.
Correct. Exactly.
But and because of tzura, what it comes above it.
What it's formed into.
Yeah.
Formed into, right? That term, right? It's the form. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
So what about our thoughts, our fears, our hopes? It's our fears, mm-hmm. let's say, a fear that makes us, mm-hmm. or, right, jealousy. Is that really something Moshe Qumran Nebuchadnezzar said? I mean, it's not, right?
It's a great question. I think for the purpose of our, I know it's an important discussion. I'm going to hold off on that just because I think it might get us a little sidetracked in terms of this. Okay. But I think we get the basic contours of this idea that there's without, again, when we bring it to the personal, it gets a little bit complicated because we're complicated, right? But the point is that there is the tables. there's less emotions when we talk about the table, right? It's basically there's a bunch of stuff, right? And there's the thing that there's the form of what it actually is in its entirety. Okay, so he says like this. He says v'yadua ki atzura chala b'achrona. The form is always the last thing. In other words, right? When I'm talking, let's go back to the table for a second. I have the pieces of metal. I have them all next to each other. It's only when I finish putting them all together, now I have a table. Before that, I had a piece of wood on the floor. I had a piece of metal on the floor. But now, when I finally finish screwing everything together, it comes at the end. Vimkein hatsura chala ba'adam biyom arba'im. So if that's true, you're following all the logic over here again. There's a little bit out there. But the point is that if it takes 40 days for the fetus to develop into something which is more lifelike, okay, then when does that take place? When does the form take place? The last moment. Because it's everything building, right? Because form is always going to be last. Just like with the table, it's only when you put it all together, now I have a form. So if I were to ask you, based on this idea that it takes 40 days for the fetus to develop, which day does form kick in? On the 40th, the last moment, right? Like all forms which take place at the end. Okay, so let's go to the next paragraph. If you're following in the English, it's the Hebrew and English, it's the second Hebrew and the second English paragraph. V'kasha adam hu b'chet. When a person sins, gamatsura shi omed shehi omed b'chomer, b'chet. The form which is connected to the material is also in sin. U'lekach amar arbaim yakenu. And therefore, the Torah says, God says, the person is deserving of 40 lashes. Ki atam shel malchus sheyesh la kosa arbaim. Because the reason we're getting lashes is connected yitziras havlad, is corresponding again to the development of the fetus. Ratza lomar, as if to say, yitzira zo shenivres barbam yom, this form, which was created in 40 days, yitzira rahi, is a bad form. Okay, so again, when I'm sinning, when I'm doing something wrong, when I've done something wrong, then it's not just my material which is corrupt. It's me who's corrupt. I can't say, okay, Sterling Motzen, why did you, spoke Lashon Hara? I spoke Lashon Hara. My tongue and my throat and my lungs spoke. I didn't speak Lashon Hara. It wasn't me. Right? That's ridiculous, right? So when I sin, then the form as well are sinful, right? I've sinned. It's me, right? So he says, and therefore, then the Torah says you should get 40 lashes. Why? Because it's not only the material that is supposed to get those malchus. It's the form as well, because I'm sinning, right? Aval, however, kashu makos solamites. Let's go through the process. One lash, two lash, three lash. Don't worry, I'm not going to go the whole way. I get to 39, right? Vikibela ones shumitzara chomer, and I receive the punishments corresponding to the 39th level of the material. Azai em betzura chet. Consequently, I don't need to get a 40th lash. Because once I've cleansed the 39 material elements, by definition, the form is now cleansed as well. Are you with me? Okay? So this is.
Can you go over again?
Yeah, I'm going to go over again. We should just pause after this. This is like one of the most complex things you've learned all week, right? I think, right? Yeah. So I'm going to say it outside. I'm going to say it outside, okay? This is form and material. Yeah. This is good. We should make a mazel stuff. We should have a kiddush. Form material is like it's a complicated idea. People gloss over this stuff in the Maharal. I figure let's jump in. This is stuff, if you're going to learn any mystical or semi-mystical writings, this terminology of form material or Aristotelian writings, this stuff comes up all the time. So let's go through it again. He basically says, it takes 40 days to develop a fetus, okay? And the 40 malchus, the 40 lashes correspond to that 40, okay? Whenever we have material and form, form always comes in at the last moment, okay? So in theory, really the chomer, it's really the material which is impure and the form which is theoretically, if you want to have impure material, you would have a totally pure form, right? It's just that when a person sins, just like the example I gave before, it's not my tongue that's sinning, it's I'm sinning. I'm now in a state of sin for doing those things. So when the Torah says you should get 40 malchus, it's saying, what does the person deserve? What they need is a cleansing of the whole forming of the whole development of the person, which is corresponding to 40. That's why the Torah says, Arbaim Yakenu. The person should be getting 40 lashes corresponding to the development of the person, right? Because when I sin, it's not just the material part that's sinning, it's me, my entire me. It's not just the piece of the table, it's the table, it's the whole thing. But practically, once you get into it, once I start getting lashes for that sin, and I get up to the 39th lash, which cleansed me from the 39 material levels that are there, what's left? The only thing that's left is form. And the form, with a clean material, so to speak, is pure as well. So there's no need to hit the 40th time. Sort of? With me?
Sounds backwards.
Backwards?
It's the form that commits the sin, not the material.
But it's only due to the... Granted, I'm not done at the screen. But it's only due to the material that exists there. And therefore, once the material is cleansed, the form is, by definition, in a state of purity.
So if two people are standing next to each other, one commits a sin, you don't punish the person standing next to him who did nothing.
Because his material is not connected to that person's form, right? The form and material always... Like a glove. Right. Like a glove. Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Having learned the Masechet Makot many years ago, I don't remember the Gemara actually explaining it in terms of Aristotelian form. Is this right there in the Gemara like that when they ask that question?
Nope.
No.
That's why we're reading this book.
Okay. Yeah. The Gemara must have another explanation.
No, it does. We're gonna see, let's see what we should do. You know, the Gemara does say, if you go to the next page...
Okay, sorry, I jumped ahead.
No, that's fine. You know what, actually, which is great, I forgot to translate a paragraph, which is perfect. So if you go actually to Uva Gemara Ka'amara, the second Hebrew paragraph, in the English, it's in the Gemara in Makos 22b, on page 2. Uva Gemara Ka'amara, so this is, right, so John's point is, wait, does the Gemara address this question? The answer is they do address it. They focus it on a more textual place. He's giving like the more Kabbalistic or philosophical reason. Textually, the Gemara says, "My Taima, what's the reason for this?" Demalkano solam etes, that we give 39 and not 40. So the Gemara says, "Iksiv arbaim yakenu bamispar," that you should hit the purse 40 times. You should be hit in that number. If the verse were to say 40 times a person should be hit in that number or with that number bamispar with that number, kidika amras, then you're right. We'd get 40. Aval hashadichsiv bimispar arbaim. When you look at the Torah, when it says you should get 40 lashes, you know, it doesn't say arbaim bimispar, 40 that number. It says within the number of 40. Okay? The literal read is not mispar arbaim, 40, the number 40, but rather bimispar arbaim, in the number 40. In the number 40. What does it mean to be in the number 40? If you're in something, you're not on the outside of it. So in Mispar Hasokim Uvmashlim the Arbaim, it's the number which rounds up to, which brings you to 40. What's in the number 40? 39, right? Because if it's in it, it's not it. It's something right beneath it. So that's the more textual explanation, okay? That the way the Torah phrases it, gives us a little bit of an inkling, okay? But the point that he's trying to bring out is that there's a deep conceptual understanding as well, guiding the rabbis, helping the rabbis understand to read it this way as well. You know, the Torah gives a little hint by framing it a little bit strange. If I were to tell you, you know, a number, I would say, you know, I want to tell you, you should lift up, lift this table up 40 times. I'd say, lift it up 40 times. If I'd say, lift it up within 40 times, what does that mean? It's strange. It's not a normal way to speak. So it tips us off that what does it mean within 40? What does that mean? There's something off over here. So together with their understanding of why you're getting 40 lashes to begin with, based on the development of a child, right? And their philosophical understanding of chomer, of form and material, and going back to the verse again, which says within 40, the rabbis weren't that far off. I mean, the two complement one another. It's that the Torah is hinting to something, and they have a conceptual understanding of the reason behind it, and now we can understand when they said 40 does not mean 40, it means 39. Makes sense. You with me? Mm-hmm. A little bit? You're holding on by like a thread, maybe? Some ish? Yes, right.
So it would make sense to me that means no more than, like, or less than 40.
Okay.
And then there would be, well, for this you get 7 lashes, and this you get 10. It seems a bit strange that no matter what it was, they got 39.
But, so the truth is, I mean, we're not going to go without going, the Gemara actually says 39 is the maximum. The next assessment that's made, 39 is the maximum, then there's an assessment made, how much could a person bear? And if it's too much for a person, then they bring it down. Yeah. Okay. So then he says like this. V'kasher he's ba'er l'chad var me'elu. We're at the final Hebrew and English paragraph on page 2. V'kasher he's ba'er l'chad var me'elu. When these things become clear to you. As tish, meaning he's saying, do you see what just happened? Again, there's this whole deep analysis. If we were to just study this, if we're just opening the stone chumash, you know, Shabbos morning, and we're reading, it says 40 lashes, we look on the bottom, it says, oh, and the rabbi said 39. We're like, what a bunch of crazy people. Where are they coming from, right? But now we just explained, and we sort of understand that there's this whole deep philosophical reason, and there's a textual hint to this, and it's all coming together. So he's just trying to use that as a window. Just one example. There are endless amount of examples of things like this. He says, when something like this becomes clear to you, as tish, he says, that should give us a thirst for all of their words. Ha'aser v'amutter, all of their prohibitions and all of their allowances. Ha'pasel v'akasher, that they invalidate and that they allow. Ha'tameh v'hatar yachdav, both with that they make impure and pure. Right? So he says, meaning he says, use this as a window into a broader understanding of rabbinic, you know, ideas in general. We're not going to go through every example. There are examples. They need to be explored. But he's saying, I want to give you just a window into the complexity of the analysis that goes into these things. And like we spoke about in weeks prior, the rabbis are not adding nor subtracting, heaven forbid, from the Torah of Moshe. Rakim mitzarfim umischabrim im Torah Moshe. Rather, they are connecting and complementing the Torah. In other words, we need them to help us understand the Torah or to access the Torah, right? That is their role, but they are not perverting the Torah like others argue that they were doing. They're not ruining the Torah. We need them to help us understand it, right? Like we spoke about earlier, like for the example that I gave when we started this, right? I work on Shabbos, right? But the Torah says, don't do malacha, don't work, right? And yet I work on Shabbos. So how does that make sense, right? So the point is that the rabbis helped us understand, and we're not going to go through that example right now, but what the word malacha actually means. What does work, what does labor mean? It can mean so many different things, right? I had friends who lived on the 16th floor of his apartment building, right? So every Shabbos, and for some reason we had this dumb idea, we'd visit him. We all lived in homes. There was one guy in my entire community who lived in apartments, and he's the house we went to on Shabbos. I don't know what we were thinking. So every Shabbos, we'd walk up 16 flights. We're young, so we didn't sweat that much, but it was hard work. Yeah, 16 flights, right? We'd usually run up, then we'd go down. Oh, I forgot something in my house. Go down, go back up. Ridiculous, right? Is that work? Maybe, right? But it's not. Why not? Right? So again, the rabbis, that's a simpler example. We know it's a closed book without their complementing of it. But then there's examples like we spoke about earlier, which he touches upon right now. Vim geder lefrishus ugedusha. And it helps protect us, right? We spoke about earlier that some of the laws of the rabbis are kind of like, the Torah is kind of like the eye, and the rabbis are like the eyelid. Right? God creates an eye, but he allows what we'll say maybe like the evolutionary process to develop us further. And so something that's very special, like your brain, has a good amount of protection, making sure that it stays safe, right? So that when someone just goes like this, my brain's still functional, Baruch Hashem, right? Whereas if I didn't have that, then it probably wouldn't be too good for the gray matter between my ears, right? So if something's very critical, then there's protection there. So the rabbis also help us help us access the Torah and stay safe within the Torah. Because had we not had that level of protection, it'd be problematic, right? He says, Hashomer Mosam, and therefore those who keep it, Olam HaBalahem Yerusha. Okay, here he gets a little poetic. The world to come is going to be an inheritance. Uva Olam HaZem Ekabel Bracha Kedusha, and in this world, they receive blessing and holiness. Ukvar Amarnu, we already said, Kel Mevakesh Alilos Varim. Someone who wants to find complaints or issues, Lo Yaspik Lo Shum Tshuva. No answer will be sufficient. He says, I want to put this out there. He says, look, I'm giving you little snippets. If you want to be cynical, I can't help you. Meaning, he's saying, if you want to have an honest discussion, here, I'll give you examples. But those who are looking for a pretext, if you have an agenda to find issues, he says, no matter what I'm going to say, it's not going to be enough. He says, ki achbos odvar macherim, they'll find other things. Ach mashe matzanu, shayusholim hishamnu. He says, but what was asked upon us, we addressed. Vim leleitzim hu yelitz. He says, for those who are cynical, they'll remain cynical. Ula navim, those who are humble, shumod ala emes, that they acknowledge the truth. Yitein Hashem yisbarachinu v'chesto aleim. God should grace them with kindness. So he says, you have to, when you have these types of questions, we need to go in with a bit of an open mind. We don't have to blindly trust, but we need to go in with a bit of an open mind. And if we're going to go in with a specific, jagged, cynical agenda, we're probably never going to walk away fully satisfied. Okay. Any questions? Any thoughts? That kind of concludes a little bit of what we were talking about. Okay. Let's now get into a very interesting example. Okay. And that is like this. The rabbis oftentimes speak in a rather funny, sometimes crude fashion. They say things which are jarring, very jarring. And you wonder, like, where in the world is this coming from? Okay, so that's the next point that he's going to address. He's going to give us a very interesting example. Okay, so let's see what this is. Okay, so he says like that. Tzluna Hashenis, the second complaint. We're on the third page. Masha Amru, that they said shebimikomos, in places kirvu masim asher ein ruyim lekarif. They brought close, which should not be brought close. Okay, we'll see what he means. V'davar zeh gam kein lo hayaro lachshav. This too should not even be something that we're thinking about. Kasher anurum shar dvar mehem asher nimtza b'divrayim. When we see other things, v'kulam dvarim tzadikim mishpatei emes, we see other things which make sense to us. They seem honest. They're filled with integrity. V'im kein ro lachshav ki shar dvarim asher rachuk b'nehem nimshach achar kol. When you see somebody, you know, that everything, let's say, I don't know, let's say your mother. Let's assume for a second you had an amazing relationship with your mother, and she always looked out for you, and she always did what's right, right? And one day she does something which seems like, you know, you walk outside and she's slashing your tires of your car. Okay? So my mother, she's like the nicest person I ever met in my life, okay? So she was slashing the tires of my car. I would come up with the most creative way to understand. I'd be like, obviously, she is not, like, doesn't have a vendetta against me and is trying to, like, harm me. Obviously, like, it must be that, I don't know, there's like something trapped in the tire that she's saving. I don't know, right? You come up with something. She's saying, similarly, she doesn't want me to leave. Exactly. She loves me so much, right? Exactly. Whatever it is, I'm going to come up with the solution, right? So he says, you know, our exercise over here is to say, look, let's try to find a number of examples where we could say, oh, this makes sense. It doesn't mean you're not going to find examples of times when things like are jarring, are very hard to understand. You know, I'll give you an example. I'll share with you something Rav Lichtenstein used to speak about a lot. Aaron Lichtenstein was the dean, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Gush Yeshiva, one of the great yeshivas in Israel. Brilliant, brilliant scholar. He was the son-in-law of Rav Yosef Soloveitchik. And he has an essay where he speaks about, you know, how earlier time in life, the mitzvah of destroying the nation of Amalek really got to him. It really got to him. It was very hard for him to understand, like, how could we go ahead and have a mitzvah to destroy a nation? It just doesn't seem in line. You know, it seems so off. Like, it's jarring. How can you do that? The mitzvah to destroy a nation? Like, it's one of the case. Someone comes and harms you, you can fight back. But Amalek, even if they didn't harm us, there's someone who says, I know I'm a descendant of Amalek, we have this mitzvah to kill them. It's what's going on over here? It's a long and it's a beautiful essay, but one of the points that he makes, he says, like, you know, if there's enough else that's making sense, enough else that's resonating, enough else that's working for, that makes sense, like, you could kind of see this in a broader context. You know, and again, it's like the example, it's an extreme example, but it's an example like the mother. Like, if so much else of the Torah is so visibly profound and visibly moral and demonstrates that it could really impact your life in such a positive way. So yes, you're going to come to times when you may not have an answer. Okay, but just like when your mother's slashing your tires and you say, okay, I don't have an answer, but I'm going to assume there's some good reason over here because 99% of my interactions with her have been positive and been kind. So there has to be something over here, even if I don't understand it. So he says, you know, first of all, he says, we're going to address some of these 1% cases, or some of us may argue 10% or 15%, these scenarios where the rabbi seems to be saying things which are bizarre. But he says, zoom out for a second. If 85% is kind and good and just and logical to us, okay. We don't always understand everything. That's true in all relationships. Where you understand your best friend, your closest person. Do you understand everything about them? No. You learn how to accept and you learn to move on. Like, okay, I don't get it. It's fine. You know, it's okay. If you understand, you know, like, we don't understand. It's fine, right? So again, some things are very jarring. I'm destroying a Amalek, if you're a sensitive person, which we should be, it's very hard. But if you say, okay, 99% of the Torah is just and kind and thoughtful and compassionate and sensitive, and this one mitzvah doesn't fit, I can live with that in a little bit of a different way, right? Okay, so that's his first point that he makes. But he says, nonetheless, we're still going to, he says, ki an safik, he says, there's no doubt, mashanira divrei chacham rechokim, that the rabbis, their logic sometimes seems like so foreign, so distant from us. He says, bishvil chiluf madregas hachachma. He says, you have to understand that their thinking was qualitatively different than ours. Okay, so explain what he means. Let's look in the next paragraph. In the Hebrew, it's on the bottom page, the third page. In the English, it's the top of the second of the third of the fourth page. Ki chachamim zal, our sages hayam biyadam mikubal divrei chachma chachmas elokis. He says the rabbis had traditions tracing all the way back to God, right? To Moshe, right? Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, the first mission of Avos, which was referenced before. Moshe received the Torah from Sinai. We believe he didn't only. I'm sorry, I forgot to number the pages today. Are you with me? I'm sorry. Everyone with me? In the English, it's the sages had traditions from Hashem. This is the beginning of the. Yeah? In the Hebrew, it's Ki Chachamim Zal. I'm sorry, I forgot to number it. Okay? And it's the fourth page. It's the sages had traditions. Okay. Ki Chachamim Zal haya biyadza mikubal divrei chachma chachma elokis. The sages had traditions tracing all the way back to God. Val pi hachachma hazos miyusadim darchem. And their ways, their words are established with this tradition. Ulefikach, and therefore, ha'adam, she'em biyadu drachim elu. a person who doesn't have this tradition. Rak dvarim tvi'im v'seichel anoshi, rachuk behem devrayim. A regular person who doesn't have this tradition, sometimes the words of the sages are impossible to understand. Kimo achiluf b'torah atzma. Just like we would say the same thing about the Torah itself. Ki kama dvarim, he says there are things in the Torah, asherim b'torah, heim rechokim me'asagas ha'adam, or hard for us to understand. Are there parts of the Torah that are hard for you to understand? Here, I'll raise my hand. Yes. Okay, but if we believe that God wrote the Torah, does that help you? It helps me. If I were to believe that the Torah is written by human beings, that a group of men sat around and made the Torah, I would have a much harder time, even if I believed in a value of tradition and community, I'd have a much harder time keeping parts of it, because parts of it say, well, they were wrong. They were wrong. And I have no problem saying that. I'm not from a place of arrogance. I don't know. Yeah, they're very bright people, very wise people. They make mistakes, right? But if I understand, if I believe that the Torah, it comes from God, then I could humble myself and say, okay, there are things which I don't claim to understand. I don't claim to understand God's divine wisdom. That'd be ridiculous. So I'm able to comfortably say, I don't know, I don't get it fully, right? And that's what he's saying over here. There, just like when we come to the Torah, we're able to say at times, okay, this is godly, and therefore I don't understand it, okay? Because Mishvil Shadivrei Torah, Lukim, Nivdalim, Biyosrim, Yasagas Adam, they are, you know, beyond, they're distant from, they're beyond our comprehension. Valzeha Derechim Divrei Chachamim, and so too are the ways of the sages. Shadivreim Him Gamkein Elokim Biyoser, their ways are godly. Again, they have godly traditions, and that's where they're building their logic out of. Lufika Chish Bidivreim Kashim Lahasik Taimam, there are things which are hard to understand, okay? Now, here we come to a very interesting little passage, okay? Let's see. I'm sorry, I'm just always fighting the clock over here. What should we do? I'm trying to think. Okay, let's see one. You know, I'll share this out. I'll share this part orally, and then we'll see the last part inside. There is a passage in the Gemara which says like this. Okay, again, what's he saying? He's saying the rabbis say logic, their wisdom, is beyond our comprehension. It comes, it's divinely influenced. Now, you have to understand also in ancient philosophy, they understand that seichel, that logic, is something which is almost like beyond us. Okay, this is a basic, again, Aristotle and others, they understood that our logic is not within us, it's almost outside of us. Anyone know the Yiddish word for an idea? My favorite word. I don't speak a lot of Yiddish. Any Yiddish? Einfall. Einfall. What does that mean? I don't know any of it. But the word, English, Einfall, it fell into me. It fell into me. Isn't that a beautiful, humble word, right? You had this brilliant idea. No, I didn't. It was an Einfall. It fell into me, right? It's such a humble, it's beautiful, right? It's there's humility, that sense that the ideas come from outside of us, right? And you feel that way sometimes. You're like, you're stuck on something. Like just this morning, you're working on something. All of a sudden, boom, like, where'd that come from? Okay, so we can explain this from, but the point is it almost is seen as coming from outside of us. Our wisdom, our logic, even though you'll say this person is, you know, is smart or whatever, but it comes from outside of us to some extent. That's how the philosophers understood it. And that's true for all logic, all wisdom. Certainly, if you're going to say that someone has like godly wisdom, you'll say that that's truly outside of us because it's in God's domain. Okay? So here's a Gemara that, you know, bite your tongue, please. This is a little bit, we're talking to adults. It's a bizarre Gemara. The Gemara in Erevin, I'm going to say this part orally, and then we'll see the last section together inside, hopefully, okay? The Gemara in Erevin says that those who mock the words of the sages, you ready? It says they will burn in hot excrement. That's what it says, okay? Now, it sounds like something like my child would say when I wasn't listening. You know, like what is it? No, not my children, of course. But the point is like, you know, like, what? It sounds like a childish, kish, right? What in the world? Like, if you disagree with us, you're going to burn in hot excrements. Like, what's going on, right? No one's able to bite their tongue. Okay, fine. But right, it's bizarre. It's bizarre, right? What kind of statement is it? It seems very childish. It seems to be like nonsensical, right? So listen to what the Maharal does. Listen to what the Maharal does. He says, let's break this down for a second. What is making fun of the wisdom of the sages means what? You're making fun of some, let's think of, here's a sage over here. By sage, I don't mean like a modern day rabbi. I mean the authors of what we call Chazal. When we say our sages, the authors of the Mishnah, the authors of the Talmud. Okay, this was this exclusive group. Okay, and if we're claiming right now, we're arguing right now that their wisdom is like outside of them, like all wisdom, but their wisdom is really outside of them. It's like godly wisdom. It's something which isn't really natural. It's not really part of a regular human existence. So it's part of them, but it's not part of them. Right? If we were to find Rabbi Akiva or Hillel, and we say, like, where are they getting these ideas from? We would say that their ideas are coming from something which is connected to them, but not really connected to them. Is that a fair framing? Does that sound right? Their wisdom is part of them, but it's also outside of them. Again, it's an Einfall. It falls from outside. It falls from God over here. It's truly godly wisdom. So it's theirs, but it's not theirs. It's connected to them. It's not connected to them. What's human waste? Human waste is the opposite extreme of that. It's something which is a part of you, but also the most not part of you, right? What is human waste? I eat poorly, I don't know, whatever you eat, it doesn't matter. But you have some food, right? And there are parts of the food which, you know, they're not going to stick around your body because they don't belong there, right? So they go through you, but they are the least connected to you, right? That's what waste is. It's waste, right? So it's part of you, but it's the least part of you as well. So this is when the rabbi said, it wasn't like, saying like anyone who disagrees with us is going to burden next year. No, the point is that it's like, well, we'll call almost like what we call like a mida keneged mida. There's a parallel over here. There's a mirroring. You are saying that the rabbis are not connect or not able to be connected to what is outside of them. You are going to be connected to what is outside of you on the opposite extreme. In other words, there's a sense of almost like a justice that's taking place over here, right? Like they are, maybe the way he says it a lot better. He says, when one mocks this, and thereby distances themselves from it, right? If godly wisdom is on this side of the spectrum, excrement is on this side of the spectrum of things that connect to human beings, right? My bones are in the middle. My brain is in the middle. My heart is in the middle because it's really a part of me, right? But there's godly wisdom over here. There's excrement over here. So he says, if you're distancing yourself from this godly wisdom by mocking it, then you're bringing yourself closer to the opposite side of the extreme, opposite side of the continuum, which is the waste. You hear, right? So it's not just this, still, again, we skipped around a lot. For those of you listening and those of you, you know, people, I know some people told me they're following along in the book. We skipped a lot of passages. I share this not just because of its shock value, but I shared it because what the Maharal's trying to sensitize us to is when you see a statement from the sages, it's not just flippant. It's not just they're saying bizarre things. It takes study. It takes thought. You know, and even this, I'm paraphrasing. He develops and develops and develops it. But the point is that they're not just going to say a silly thing. There's a logic to it. There's a reason to it. There's a wisdom to it. So here too, what they're saying is you're distancing yourself from the thing, the wisdom, which is on this side of the continuum. Fine. Then it makes sense that you're going to be as far away from that as possible. And that's the idea of suffering, so to speak, in this burning excrement. You with me? Okay, fine. Let's now see one last example. Then next week, we're going to start a bit of a new topic. Parakamah de Sanhedrin. Okay, first chapter of Sanhedrin. Says we're on the second to last page. Okay, the final like page on the first side of that last page. Parakamah de Sanhedrin, the first chapter of Sanhedrin. Amar of Kahana of Kahana said, Sanhedrin shirau kulam lechova. Let's say you have a court, and they are judging a capital crime. And they decide, and you listen, everyone's going around the room, and everyone's like, guilty, 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 guilty. They didn't yet wait. They didn't yet give their final judgments. But everyone is, their day is wrapping up, okay? And basically, you go around the room, everyone's, this guy is totally, totally guilty, okay? Potron oso. The Gemara says, we let the guy go home. Right? Doesn't get more bizarre than that. What? That's the again, seems so bizarre. It seems so backward. If every one of these sages, if any one of these leaders are saying the person is guilty, then you go home? No, kill him now, right? It makes no sense. Right? If you were to say, if the Supreme Court was unanimous about anything, Mashiach would come. Okay, but if the Supreme Court was unanimous about something, right, then you'd say, okay, it's logical, it makes sense. And here we're saying the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin, is all saying the guy's guilty, he goes home. Doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense. Let's keep on. Let's read reading. So where it says, the Gemara says, my time, why is it? Kivan de Gemiri, since we have a tradition, we learned, Debai halana sadin, lemeve leizchusa, there is a law that whenever it comes to capital crimes, you are not allowed to have a one-day judgment for capital crimes. What you do with capital crimes is when they come to the conclusion, they reach their conclusion, and then they wait a day, and then they reconvene and discuss it one last time. That's called literally lana sadin, means like sleeping on the court case. You sleep on it. You are not allowed whenever you come to that conclusion, you have to sleep on it. Okay, vahani, and these people, sulo chazul eschusa, the Gemara says they can no longer find merit. That's the end of the quote from the Gemara. So he says, gam davar zeh zar beinam. This is also very strange. It's strange to all of us. Vishvil shiro kul nechova, yeh patr midina? Because they all saw someone is guilty, they're going to be exempt? Okay, so he says like this. Kvar amarnu lefnei zeh, we said earlier, came based in ra'oi ladun, rak davar shu mishpat emes, mikol tzar. He says, really, courts are only able to rule, only able to execute a judgment, only when it is completely just on every side. Let's read on, we'll see what he means. He has Shechina b'Yisrael, the divine presence lives among the Jewish people. V'hisha osa mishpat l'Bereshem. And therefore, it's really God who does justice. And what does he mean by that? Let me give you an example. There's a famous Gemara, also Makos, which says, Rabbi Akiva says, that if I would be on a court case for capital punishment, there would never be anyone executed. You know why? Because you know what you have to do to be killed in Judaism? Let's say it's a murder case, okay? First of all, you need two witnesses to warn the person. Let's say a person's going, person, how's it gone? Two people need to walk over them. Excuse me, sir. Can I interrupt your massacre over here? I need to ask you something. I need to let you know that if you go ahead with this, then we are going to report to the courts and they will kill you. Thank you, guys. Okay. And he continues on, right? So that's number one. Then they have to watch him do so. And it's not enough that they watch him go into a room and he walks out and everyone's dead. Heaven forbid. We have to watch him go ahead and commit this crime. Possible? Plausible? Not really. Okay? Adultery, same thing, right? You have to see the you have to see the all you have to warn the person, see the exact act. What are you talking about? Like, this is not going to happen, right? So basically the Gemara basically has all these sages saying, "We would never execute someone," right? And so you wonder to yourself, okay, so then where's justice going to be found in Israel, right? How's this going to take place? And so the first point he makes is, you know, the court, I'm going to paraphrase, not exactly what he says, but he says, you know, a mishpat Elokim hu, we believe in God. We believe that God will take care of things. This world, the next world, ultimately, we see things which are unjust in the world. We see things which don't add up in the world. But if you believe in God, you believe that ultimately, even if in this lifetime it's not fully, everyone's going to get their judgment. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. At the same time, we as humans have responsibility to affect justice. It would be immoral for us to look the other way, to not even set up a court, to not try, to not do something. But we have our limitations. We have our limitations. And unless we are 1,000% certain, we can't touch it. So only in extreme, extreme, extreme circumstances where we know every single detail can we do something about it. Okay? And don't worry. Justice will be found because God takes care of things. But at the same, right? So there's this balancing act between human responsibility and a belief that God is controlling in control of the world. Right? So he says like this. He says, first of all, you have to understand. He says, any questions you have about how the court functions, again, as Jews, we believe that the court is just fulfilling a basic responsibility to say that there's a destination, that there is that we as humans are telling, giving a message to people that we care, that we want to do whatever we can, but we have limitations, right? So we ultimately believe that God takes care of things. Okay, but then let's go to the last Hebrew paragraph on the Hebrew on the second last page, or if you're following the English, it's the first paragraph on the final page. Ki haTorah tzricha la'asos halanas adin. The Torah necessitates sleeping on the judgments. Mipnekia adam hu chomri, again that word, because man is material, meaning we are limited. V'chol seichel v'das asher yeshlo hitalos b'chomer eino seichel bar. Our logic by definition is flawed. He says we're human beings, we are material beings, and even our logic, you know, a little bit to Rachel's question before, you know, even wisdom, even thought processes are part of our material, physical existence. And so by definition it's flawed. Ulefikach tzarech halanas adin. And therefore, why do we have the sleeping on the judgments? Because we recognize the limitations of our judgment, right? It helps us crystallize. If you sleep on something, right? You ever wake up, you're thinking about things, then you wake up and, I know what I'm going to do, right? It's very common, right? Because we're limited, and simply sleeping on it is valuable. You know, by the way, psychologists would say one of the reasons that we have a little more clarity is because there's so many, things that psychological barriers that we put up. Like maybe we know what the right answer we really want to do, but we don't allow ourselves to think that way. When we sleep, you know, the whole notion of dreams, I'm going on a big tangent here. The whole notion of dreams is that, you know, all of our inhibitions, that's the word I'm looking at, all our inhibitions, even we have our own inhibitions in our mind. We don't even let ourselves think about certain things. We don't allow ourselves to feel certain ways, right? When we dream, we don't fight. And so whatever fears that you have during the day, sometimes they'll come out at night because normally we're holding on to them during the day, right? So just simply sleeping makes us a little bit less chomer-like, a little like all of the things that hold us back are not there as much. He's not saying that exactly, but the point is that I recognize my thinking process. As wise as the heads of the courts were, they're lacking. They're lacking. And therefore it's critical that we sleep on something, okay? So we certainly have to sleep on something when it comes to capital crimes. Right? If you made a perversion of justice, if you made a mistake with capital crimes, and we believe in capital punishments, there's no going back. Right? It's a big deal, right? This law of sleeping on the case does not apply by monetary laws. Ubeistin. So therefore he says like this: Beistin Shiro Kulam Lechova. And therefore, if you finish today, today's Thursday, and the court all says, you know, before we go to sleep, let's go do a quick check. What do you all think? And we all go around, we all say guilty, 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 guilty. All of us say guilty. It's ki'ilu nifsak din. Even though we're going to sleep on it, even though we're going to reconvene tomorrow, it's as if we already ruled. Aval kasharo kulam lechova kvar hu mistulakim adin. Right? Because if everyone went ahead, okay, I skipped a couple of words. Let me just say it outside. If let's say we went around this room and I were to share with you a moral dilemma And 99% of, I don't know how many people are here, whatever it is, you know, 99% of the group over here would say that, you know, guilty or X. And one person would say Y, right? As opposed to, let's say we all say X. What would be the difference? If we all say X, what would we do? I'm right. Everyone says the same thing, right? But if one person says Y, then at least there's a tiny part of me which says, maybe I'm not right. Right? Why did Irma say why? Sorry, I don't mean to pick on you. Why did Irma say why? Right? If Irma said why, there's probably a reason. What am I missing? Right? And I start to think and analyze, right? So he says like this. He says that since the Torah necessitated that we never go into a capital punishment without sleeping on it. So if, as long as there is at least one person on this court who disagreed, then I'm sleeping on it. But if everyone went ahead and said guilty, then I could pretend I'm sleeping on it, but I'm not really sleeping on it. Because if everyone around us, everyone said X, everyone said guilty, then I'm not, I know I said the right thing, right? So do you see the profound like depth of the psychology over here, of what the rabbis are doing, right? So yeah, it's true. So let's just, again, break this down. If a whole court says a person is guilty, then they go free. Are we claiming that the person is not guilty? No, they're probably guilty. What about the fact that they're going to go loose? What do we say to that? We believe in God. That's point number one. Point number one is that the whole function of the courts is limited to begin with. We ultimately believe that God runs the world. We have to do our part, but God runs the world. In terms of our responsibility, so why do we ultimately let the person go free? Not because we don't believe that they're guilty, but because we know that we're not giving this case the proper attention. Because if everyone around us says the same thing, human psychology will dictate that we will not second guess ourselves. As contrarian as you are, if everyone around you is saying the same thing, we're probably going to go along with it. And therefore, we didn't do justice. We didn't properly analyze this case. And that's why the rabbis say the person goes free. So why are we sharing this example? It's just another example of something that the rabbi said, which seems bizarre and crazy. It makes no sense. But then we start to dig and think and reflect and contemplate why. And, you know, and try to understand it. You say, there's chachma. There's deep wisdom over here. Profound wisdom. And that's what he's trying to open our eyes to. And as he said earlier, we could go through endless amounts of cases, and we will go through more cases. You know, and there's so many other topics within this broader topic that we need to analyze. You know, someone asked me, it was right before the class, I was listening online, asked me about cases where the rabbis seem to be going against modern day science. We're going to deal with that. And cases where the rabbis share like these fantastical tales, which no way they happen, of dragons and this and that. What are they talking about? Again, we'll get there. But the point that he's trying to impress upon us right now is that don't just immediately flippantly dismiss. Recognize, just through these few examples, that there's wisdom over here. There's a certain thought process that we may not be exposed to. Start with those examples, and then approach the other examples like you'd approach my mother slashing my tires, with a little bit more compassion, a little bit more humility, a little bit more curiosity, and with that, we'll hopefully have a bit of a better understanding of the rabbis. Okay, have a great day, everyone. Thank you. Have a good Shabbat.